Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Wayback Machine, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. With each show, your host takes you back through time in a conversation with a mat legend from the past. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents the Wayback Machine.
Lou Thesz, known to the world as Mr. Wrestling, is Mike Anscombe's guest on Sports Probe. Next.
To some people, it's a joke and should be treated accordingly. To others, it's as serious as their first cup of coffee in the morning. Its cast of characters is as colorful and kooky as the latest rock opera. Its good guys are good, king-sized versions of Nelson Eddy without a Jeanette McDonald. And its bad guys are very, very bad, whose behavior would be the envy of Attila the Hun. It's wrestling, and from Malaysia to Mississauga, it's big business. One of those who has reaped the dividends is the legendary Lou Thesz. Wrestling today is not wrestling the way it was when Lou Thesz first started. It has changed, and he has reluctantly accepted that change, or at least he has learned to live with it.
Doesn't that bother you, Lou, being a purist in terms of wrestling, a fellow who really does know how to wrestle, who does not rely on gimmicks? It must put you in a position, I would think, where you feel a little bit embarrassed by the way it's gone.
On occasion, I'm disturbed by it. You're right, I really am. But the thing that I keep in mind, and Ed Lewis, this old strangler, who was about as straight-laced as they come, told me years ago, he said, in wrestling, he said, you're going to have to move with the trend of the times. He said, always remember what I'm telling you. And he said, eras change. And he said, our sport was great prior to your time, speaking of when I started. And he said, it can remain to be a great sport, but he said, you're going to have to learn to move with the trend of the times and be sure that it's a spectator sport and that it will draw money. And as we said earlier, they've done that with basketball, they've done it with football, and automobile racing, or whatever, with most of the sports.
But nothing like wrestling, though.
Not quite as garish, and they just don't have the freedom to do it. And the reason for that is that maybe the athletic commissions don't sit on them as hard as they should. But you know what the athletic commissions know very well? They know who brings the tax money into the coffers for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And in the United States, I would say that wrestling would probably bring in 100 times the amount of income that perhaps boxing would to the states.
Mm-hmm.
That have athletic commissions.
When you won the world championship, or when you won a match, you really did win the match and it wasn't a setup.
Oh, no, nothing like that, no.
When did it change?
Well, the Gorgeous George era came about immediately after the war. And he had the long robes, and I'm sure a lot of people remember that name. And had his hair blonde, and did a thing, and switched into the ring, and did a lot of things. And
what he did, he didn't project the stereotype wrestler.
No, he did not at all, no.
Hopefully he didn't.
No, and he would have gold-plated hairpins and call them Georgie pins and throw them at the people. And the children would like to pick them up, and the old, the women, and he would find some elderly woman walking into the ring and stand there and look at her and shake his head as if she were a peasant or something, and just, you know, the place would just see it and they want to kill him.
He was the kind of guy who's, I suppose, his masculinity you could question.
That's right, you could. You definitely could, right. But as I told you earlier, Bob Hope got interested in him. They took him over to the Paramount lot, he and Jack Benny, and dressed him in the robes and had his hair done, and they put him on two or three TV shows. In fact, Bob Hope was a second in two or three wrestling matches. And I talked to Bob on a set when he was doing fancy pants with Lucille Ball. And he told me, I thought he was a real cute guy. And he said, yes, and he said, could he wrestle? And I had to answer him honestly. He could. His name was George Wagner. He wrestled very well. But he made more money as Gorgeous George.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the whole thing started, Mike.
I guess when the World Championship really meant something, and there was significance there, and you were only 19 or 20 years of age, back in 1937, how it all came about.
I was 20 years of age, and yes, it was very important, particularly to me. It's probably the highlight of my life, and you can imagine a 20-year-old boy, the son of a Hungarian immigrant that was a shoemaker, and that was my trade, and I always said that if wrestling wasn't good to me, I'd go back to fixing shoes, you know?
It was obviously very good, too.
It was very good, yes.
Tell me about that match. It was with a fellow named Everett Marshall.
Everett Marshall, a great wrestler, a very fine athlete. And For the match, I had some tremendous coaching. I had Ed Stranger Lewis and Ray Steele and a fellow named George Trakas, who was a three-time Olympic winner, and other fellows that I, on occasion, worked out with. And we'd go to the various schools. We would go to Illinois and Missouri and Indiana, the schools that were close by. And some of my mentors, they knew the coaches, who later became my friends. And we would work out with the heavyweights and then catch the good ones coming through St. Louis, excuse me, which at that time was the seat of wrestling culture. All the biggies worked out there. When the good ones came through town or wrestled in St. Louis, that was before TV. The showcase for wrestling at that time was public workouts. And when I wrestled as an amateur in Missouri, I would watch them and never dreaming, of course, that I would be sitting in a seat one day that I would work out with them. But winning the title was pretty well handled and manipulated by Ed Lewis and Ray Steele and my Olympic coach. And I would work out every day, or if I thought I was getting overtrained, why, I would work out every second day. But when we would play a couple of games of handball to warm up and then wrestle for 2 or 3 hours. And that was nonstop. I had 6 training partners at the time, and they'd throw a new one at me every 5 minutes. And you get a feel as your competition is actually what happens. It's like you're playing golf or whatever you're participating in. If you're really pushed to the wall, sometimes you do a little better than you think you can. And the promoter in St. Louis also was with us and also instrumental in booking the champion. I was very popular. I was a young boy, and St. Louis had not had a hometown wrestler ever that amounted to a great deal. So they thought they had something. And the night that they were supposed to wrestle, or the day before I was supposed to wrestle in St. Louis, Everett Marshall got the news that his opponent, and I've forgotten who that was now, but he had been injured, and they had a young kid to replace him.
You were a young kid.
I was a young kid. And ready, you know. And I was a young kid, and he didn't take that seriously, of course, because normally we wouldn't take a boy like that seriously, because you're not too fearful of a 20-year-old that just got out of the amateurs, you know, because you know what he's going to do, normally. And anyway, they threw me in there with him. And had my coaches, which gave me a lot of moral support right at ringside there, you know. And after about an hour, Marshall stepped back and looked at me and said, "You're in pretty good shape, kid." And I said, "Yes, I've been training." And I knew he could tell because I was leaning on by degrees. The first 45 minutes, I didn't try to do too much with him, following the advice of my tutors. And I let him go ahead and try to beat me. And little by little, I was pulling the cork on him, you know. And then at about an hour, when I knew that things looked a little better, I started turning the heat on, you know. And I was wrestling at my pace and not his. And he was moving around a lot more than he wanted to. And at the 2 hour mark, he was defending himself. There was a tremendous amount of stamina that you couldn't see or feel. Every time he got in trouble, he was I guess you'd run on float, and he moved out of there. I couldn't hold him. He was a strong devil. But at 2.5 hours, I knew I had him. It was just a matter of time then, because I felt great. And this sounds stupid to say that in wrestling 2.5 hours, I felt great, but I did.
About a month later, though, you lost your title.
Yes,
in much
did.
The same way.
Yes.
Explain that, Lou.
Well, the day after the match, I went to the wrestling office to settle my financial situation, get my money, which I needed at the time. I just really needed it. So I went up there, and I got my money, and they pushed a contract in front of my nose.
Who's they?
The promoter in St. Louis. He was kind of a double agent. He was on my side, maybe, you know. And that's the way. If he had a piece of me, he liked me, right? Okay. So he and 2 or 3 other people that were involved in Los Angeles and Boston, a fellow named Paul Bowser, another man in Los Angeles, and they said, "Well, if we're going to be strapped with this kid for the champion," which apparently they were at the time, "we're going to get him on a piece of paper." So I looked at the man, and as naive as I was, at 20 as you are, you know, and I didn't like it because I'd been advised by my coaches, my tutors, Ed Lewis and Ray Steele particularly, a couple of old pros, and they said, "Well, they're going to push some paper in front of you. You better be careful what you sign, you know." So I was. I read it carefully, and the thing that really stood out was a very fine print that said 5%, you know, that I was going to receive for wrestling.
You were the champion.
I was the champion.
You're going to get 5%.
Well, that didn't set too well because I knew I had some expenses and had training partners to pay and so forth. And not being a math expert, I knew better than that, right? So anyway, I didn't sign it. And they had some good fortune then because a week later I was in Philadelphia and wrestling the tournament. And whether it was prearranged or not, I don't know, but I got kicked in the neck. And I got kicked pretty well, nearly knocked me out, but not quite. And I beat the man. And then I got an infection in my neck here, and I was in bad shape. I was really in bad condition. I just couldn't wrestle at all, and I was so grotesque. And, you know, like I told you, Frankenstein would look like a doll compared to me. But nevertheless, went ahead and wrestled in Boston. They booked me in Boston against a fellow named Steve Casey, who had wrestled here. And he was adequate. He was a competent wrestler from Ireland. And I don't say this to the low-rate Steve or anything, but he didn't have any business in there with me at that time. I mean, as it, wrestling for the championship, but I was out of the hospital. I had been out of the hospital for 2 days. They put me on a train, shipped me up there.
You didn't want to wrestle?
No, I didn't. No, but they forced me to. They told me that if I didn't wrestle, why they would vacate the title and have a tournament, and I would have to start all over. You know, well, being a naive, stupid kid, why I went for that, you know, razzle-dazzle. And like I said, they dazzled me with their footwork, you know. And, but anyway, I went for it, and I lost the match.
You could be manipulated then, Lou, and not really
not
aware of it.
Not even know it, no. A lot of the kids are manipulated but are not aware of it. Oh, I know that.
Lou, are you saying that even now that you're not involved in matches where you know that you're going to win regardless of what happens?
The only way that I know that I'm going to win, I can't give you a contract on it, mm-hmm. but the only way that I know that I'm going to win is because I know the men very well. And I know who can wrestle and how well they can wrestle. And I know what they know, and I always think that I know a little more than they do. You know, I've gotten to that point now. And I really do.
You don't get into situations where
somebody asks me to pick a match?
Well, somebody says, look, you're going to win, and this guy's going to lose, and so on.
No, I don't get involved in that at all.
But it
never has been.
But it doesn't.
I don't know about that.
Really?
Really. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not involved in anything like that. No one's ever approached me. And I doubt that they approach very, very few wrestlers. Because most people have a little personal pride about them. And it doesn't make any sense to me. It really doesn't.
But we see instances on film where guys take swings at one another and there's a loud noise, and the guy doesn't come within 6 inches of hitting the opponent.
Well, there again, maybe I think we mentioned earlier that you might have a couple of fellows that like each other and go out there and go through motions. And I've seen fights like that, too, like I have seen wrestling matches like that. I've seen the same thing you've seen. And when I see things like that, I just shudder because I know that they don't belong in there.
In 5 years, and he continues to draw the fame. And I would think as soon as he loses, then his drawing power would go, and that in effect would affect the gate, the wrestling gate, so he can't really afford to lose, or the promoters can't really afford to have
him. Well, as long as he's winning, he's fine. He would probably draw money if he lost. I think he would. So far as him constantly winning, he has a lot of latitude. He does a lot of things that other people don't do. And I think a lot of it should be curbed. You bet it should. I think it's absolutely right. I don't think he would. And again, this gets into the vanity thing. I don't think he'd have that kind of success with me. I really don't. No one has ever approached me to say, we will give you $10, $20, $30, $50, or $100,000 to lose a match to someone in a fixed match. Maybe because they thought I wouldn't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very possible.
But there are matches that are fixed. We all know that.
There may be two fellas that like each other go out there and may do something like that. But so far as saying you lose a match to this fellow, I'll tell you why it doesn't make too much sense, Mike. If you travel about the world, and that's what a wrestler must do, he can't stay in one area too long. His record will dictate his bargaining power. If he has a decent record, he can go anywhere and say, well, I will work for X number of dollars per match, or a guarantee. If he's a palooka, a fellow that just can't defend himself, or loses a lot of matches, he's the lower end of the totem pole, mm-hmm. and some of them eke out a living.
You've used the word manipulate an awful lot in this conversation, Lou. Who does the manipulating?
Well, sometimes I even do it myself, you know. I would get people in a position to do the things that I want them to do, and you learn to do these things, using the word again, subtly, without them even knowing what you're doing, you know. Like having a fellow make weight or get heavier, Or like I talked about getting someone on the road and then have someone head them off at the draw. And anyone can do it. Some of the promoters do it. Some of the wrestlers do it. And if I get a young fellow, like I had a boy from Hawaii, Sam Steamboat Jr., I took him and I steered him around, and he won the Southern Heavyweight Championship, and I was as much responsible for that as Sammy was. Mm-hmm. But I saw that he got booked with the right guy that I thought he could beat, you know, which is maybe not quite the way it should be done, but I love Sammy and I wanted to see him succeed.
Do you ever see fellows who are big at the box office who are maybe the world champion in this area or some other area who you know have absolutely no right to be representing wrestling in that manner? Doesn't that bother you?
It bothers me. But there's some gratification there, too, with me. Of course, again, this gets back to the same old ego problem. They don't try to book them with me, and they don't try to book them with fellows like Pat O'Connor or anyone else. And the promoters that really know what they're doing, and like Frank Tunney, he knows. He's the reason I like to work with Frank Tunney is he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I'll bet you hear an awful lot of the same things we all hear about wrestling, that it's fixed, that it's all put on, and so on. Is it?
Not that I know of. Because I've been around the building here for some 43 years, and there is nobody told me.
These matches are legit. The best man wins?
The best man wins, I would say, 99 times out of 100. You can't be sure that 100%, because human nature being what it is, somebody is liable to do something that you're not aware of. But generally speaking, I would say the best man always wins.
What kind of guy wrestles? What kind of a man takes up wrestling as a profession?
Well, I think the usual ones that are, you might say, muscular, they're people that like to play games of football and...
Physical kind of
physical, yes. And wrestling actually is the basic of all athletic endeavors. Like, in other words, it puts you in better conditioning. I think Angelo Mosca spoke of that when he said it probably put him 3 or 4 years more onto his football career because he wrestled than the off season.
What kind of character is a wrestler?
Well, we have a lot of characters, but generally speaking, I think they're most of good character. We have bad apples, of course. There are bad apples every barrel, but the majority, like, you can't fault fellows like Pat Flanagan and Whipper Watson, Lord Layton and Lou Fez and Strangler Lewis and Jim Londis and so forth. They're all fine, fine gentlemen.
Pretty good wrestlers. Who's the greatest? Who's the greatest?
The greatest of all time, in my 43 years being around wrestling, I would have to say Lou Fez. He had everything, including personality, ability, his word was good, reliability, and so forth.
It's very demanding. Sometimes, after having been on the road for weeks and weeks and having been married for years and years, I've said it in jest in the dressing room sometimes. I said, well, I'm going to have to call home to see if I still got one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little more accurate than you would think that it is. It's said in jest, but it really isn't too funny, because I'm on my second marriage, and the marriage really has a couple of strikes on it in this kind of a situation. It does in athletics, or showbiz, or anyone that travels a great deal. I think it takes two really adult people, and it takes a lot more than that sometimes.
You know, another popular phrase in recent years is a sports groupie. Young ladies who seem to be very attractive athletes. Is there that kind of grouping in wrestling?
Well, there may be. I have not, and I'm not trying to exonerate myself from anything, because I'm like everyone else. I think chicks are beautiful, you know. Maybe not like everybody else, or like most of us. But anyway, the females do love the beefcake. And, like, you know, a lot of guys like it. We said years ago, the cheesecake, you know, they have the things on the wall, the photographs of the nude or semi-nude gals. And I'm sure that a lot of the gals are turned on by bodies that are attractive and are receptive. And that's our good fortune. But
why do you wrestle? Why do you have to sacrifice so much? I don't think you need the money. And at 58 years of age, you think maybe you'd be settling down a little bit. So why?
I need to do something, Mike, that I love to do. I'm a very fortunate person in one aspect. I'm doing the thing that I love to do. I wrestle as an amateur, and if I weren't wrestling for money, I would do it for nothing. And I love it. I love the razzle dazzle of it. I love to get around and see my old cronies and eat in the spots that I knew. And in short, I guess I'm a gypsy, you know, with the Hungarian background. It was easy.
What kind of a life have you had from wrestling? How much money have you made during your career?
I've done very well financially. The world has been good to me. It's been my oyster for a number of years. And it still is. Everything's fine. All I got to do is pick up the telephone and call like I call Frank Tenney. I said, Frank, I'm going to be in Florida for a week. And I said, I've got a couple weeks off before Christmas, and I'd like to come up and visit you. He said, you're booked when you want to come in, you know? And that kind of a relationship is beautiful, and I love it, and I'm happy to be here. And it's been my life, and actually, it's all that I know. It seems pretty narrow and restricted, maybe, but we do our own thing, and we're night people, and I've learned to love it.
See To You With Love, Sunday at 3 o'clock here on the Global Television Network. Because of the sports special tonight at 8 o'clock on Global, Follyfoot will not be seen this week, but will return at its regular time next Saturday. Stay tuned for The World of Wicks next.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.